Chapter 8 Steadfast Sons. The foothills of the Spinkhar mountain range, 24 miles due south of Jalalabad in the borderland between Afghanistan and Pakistan, were once home to hundreds of olive plantations. For tens of thousands of acres, the farms clustered along the banks of the Nangarhar Canal, a monumental hydroelectric irrigation project completed in the 1960s, when Afghanistan was safe and liberal enough to form a regular stop on the hippie trail from Europe to India and the Far East. By the turn of the new millennium, however, more than 20 years of continuous warfare had almost destroyed the canal's capacity to pump life-giving water to the groves, all but killing off what had once been a flourishing business. One day, in the fall of 2001, with yet another foreign invasion brewing just beyond the horizon, a father sat with three of his young sons in the shade of one of the few remaining olive trees. Together, they performed a simple ceremony of farewell. To each of the three boys, the father gave a misbaha, a set of prayer beads symbolizing the 99 names of God in classical Arabic. It was as if we pulled out our livers and left them there, one of the sons was to recall. Then the father took his leave and disappeared into the mountains, heading for a familiar redoubt known as the Black Cave, or, in the local Pashto language, Tora Bora. Hamza bin Laden, who received a rosary that day, was to spend most of the next decade in captivity. Behind bars, he was to grow up, receive his education, marry, become a parent twice over. But still, Hamza missed his own father deeply. "How many times, from the depths of my heart, I wished to be beside you," Hamza wrote to Osama in 2009. "I remember every smile that you smiled at me, every word that you spoke to me, and every look that you gave me." Hamza grew up with a fervor for jihad and a determination to follow in the footsteps of his illustrious father. Toward the end of his life, as we have seen, bin Laden began grooming Hamza for leadership. He made plans for Hamza to join him in Abbottabad. For a while, the portents seemed encouraging. Khalid, who was with her husband in Abbottabad, told Hamza of a very good dream she had in which you were conducting Adhan, the Muslim call to prayer, from atop a very high building, in the same voice in which you said, "Stay strong, my father, for heaven awaits us and victory is ours if God permits," a reference to the poem that Hamza recited during his brother Muhammad's wedding in 2000. In the end, Hamza and bin Laden never saw each other again. But 14 years after their farewell under the olive tree, and 4 years after his father's death, Hamza's return to the jihadi stage, along with several of his father's most trusted and competent lieutenants, would portend a bin Ladenist resurgence. Today, even as the Islamic State slowly dwindles, its parent organization, Al-Qaeda, is making a comeback. In the months after 9/11 and the fall of the Taliban, a parade of bin Laden family members and high-ranking Al-Qaeda figures made their way to the Shia stronghold of Iran. At first blush, that may seem a surprising destination for some of the world's most fervent Sunni extremists, men who pepper their public utterances with slurs calling Shia Muslims rejectionists and apostates. But in the wake of the awful attacks on New York and Washington, the Islamic Republic seemed like the best of a narrowing range of bad options, primarily because it was the one place in the Muslim world where America's military and law enforcement writ would not run. The Iranian authorities, for their part, simply deported most of the Al-Qaeda members they captured, but they held on to a handful of high-value detainees to use as bargaining chips in hostage negotiations and other sticky situations. Among these valuable hostages were bin Laden relatives like Hamza and his mother, as well as Shura Council members like Abu Khair al-Masri, the head of the political committee, Abu Muhammad al-Masri, master of Al-Qaeda's training camps, and of course the old tactician Saif al-Adl. Today, more than 15 years after 9/11, these three men, Saif, Abu Khair, and Abu Muhammad, are the top Al-Qaeda operatives not in American custody, apart from al-Qaeda's leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri. The protean status of these al-Qaeda grandees during their long Iranian captivity is in many ways a reflection of the paradoxical relationship that developed between Sunni al-Qaeda and the world's foremost Shia power. On an ideological level, the two sides despised each other, and for this reason their attempts to work together never quite came to fruition, as Saif al-Adl, for one, was painfully aware. Moreover, Tehran had long counted bin Laden's Afghan allies, the Taliban, among its more troublesome regional irritants. On the other hand, Iran had at least two reasons to hold out the possibility of better conditions, or even freedom. First, al-Qaeda or its associated groups would from time to time get hold of Iranian diplomats as hostages, and Tehran would need bargaining chips to set them free. Secondly, Iran and al-Qaeda shared common enemies in the shape of the great Satan, America, and its top Arab ally, Saudi Arabia. Assad, the Ayatollah's protege in Damascus, had helped Sunni jihadists throw sand in America's gears. Perhaps Iran might try something similar. It was therefore in Tehran's interest to keep the senior al-Qaeda militants alive and well until such time as they proved useful, either as leverage or as attack dogs. Thus, while al-Qaeda frequently bemoaned the imprisonment of its people in Iran in the same breath as that of their comrades more firmly incarcerated at Guantanamo Bay or black sites, the U.S. State Department simultaneously complained repeatedly that Iran remained unwilling to bring to justice senior al-Qaeda members it continued to detain and refused to publicly identify those senior members in its custody. Iran previously allowed al-Qaeda facilitators to operate a core facilitation pipeline through Iran since at least 2009, enabling al-Qaeda to move funds and fighters to South Asia and Syria. The Iranian authorities reportedly permitted Mahmud, the factotum, to serve as al-Qaeda's emissary to Iran and facilitated his travel back and forth across the border from Pakistan. Thus, the status of the al-Qaeda prisoners tended to vary with the degree of leverage their organization enjoyed. Immediately following their arrest in Shiraz in April 2003, Saif, Abu Khair, and Abu Muhammad found themselves hauled off to Tehran and jailed for around 20 months in the dungeons of a building belonging to Iran's feared intelligence apparatus. They were held incommunicado and without charge, but they were neither mistreated nor even formally interrogated. Around the beginning of 2005, they were moved to a spacious military compound with an apartment complex, a soccer field, and a mosque, adjacent to a training camp for one of the many Shia militant groups on Tehran's payroll. Their families were allowed to join them, although at least one fellow detainee suspected that this was no more than a ruse to allow the Iranians to keep tabs on potentially troublesome family members. A few months later, Saif, Abu Khair, and Abu Muhammad were moved again to an apartment block in a different part of the same military base. The Iranian authorities had split the al-Qaeda detainees into four groups, one of which comprised most of the senior leaders as well as members of the bin Laden family, including Hamza and his mother. Their new apartments, however, proved cramped, dingy, and unsanitary to the point where some residents began to show signs of mental and physical illness. In mid-2008, the detainees staged a protest. The authorities broke up the demonstration and beat all the prisoners, including the women. Nevertheless, about a year later, the detainees and their families were moved once again to a third area on the base, a walled-off section containing neat, recently refurbished houses, each with its own yard. But this was still a prison, after all. The houses stood surrounded by three layers of fences, of which the innermost was capped with razor wire and surveillance cameras. The prisoners remained restive. In fact, many considered this sedentary, secluded life even further beneath their dignity than the squalor of their previous accommodations. For these hardy mujahideen, the sense of suburban comfort only heightened their humiliation. One of them told his captors he would sooner be extradited to Israel than spend any more time in the gilded cage the Iranians had prepared for them. In March 2010, the prisoners staged what one detainee later described as a huge act of disturbance. This time, masked, black-clad Iranian troops were ordered in to storm the compound. The soldiers beat the men and some of the children and hauled the senior detainees off to solitary confinement for 101 days. The detainees' ability to communicate with the outside world seems to have varied tremendously over time. At first, they were held, as one U.S. official put it, under virtual house arrest, not able to do much of anything. Phone calls to family members were strictly limited. But the strictures gradually loosened, just as the detainees' living conditions slowly improved. The Iranian authorities eventually set up a system whereby minders could send emails on behalf of their wards, and each week permitted one prisoner to browse the web, although full internet access was not allowed. And there were other ways of communicating with the outside. Saif al-Adl's father-in-law, Mustafa Hamid, who was held in Iran under looser conditions, visited the main group of detainees every few months. With his greater liberty, Hamid was in a position to serve as a courier. Indeed, this may be how Saif was able to publish his column on security and intelligence in the AQAP house magazine Muskar al-Batar. Other detainees managed to escape and bring manuscripts with them, like bin Laden's daughter, Iman, who smuggled out the text of Abu Khaith's 20 Guidelines on the Path of Jihad, a book highly critical of Zarqawi's violence against civilians in Iraq, and eventually had it published, with a foreword by another detainee, the former al-Qaeda religious leader Abu Hafs al-Muratani. Despite their restlessness, the detainees managed to create behind bars elements of their own miniature society. The men of the compound came together 5 times a day for prayers and conversation at the mosque. Requests to allow the children to attend school apparently went unmet. But Hamza's mother, who was well-educated, urged her son to pursue learning as best he could, and a group of senior detainees took it upon themselves to educate him in Quranic study, Islamic jurisprudence, and the Hadith. While still in custody, Hamza married a daughter of Abu Muhammad al-Masri and became a father twice over. Al-Qaeda lobbied hard for the release of its top men, and by 2010, the group had acquired a bargaining chip of its own. 2 years previously, Pakistani tribal elements had kidnapped an Iranian diplomat and sold him as a hostage to Al-Qaeda. Through the Haqqani Network, one of the armed groups that protects Al-Qaeda's Waziristan hub, a prisoner swap was arranged. On August 10th, Hamza bin Laden was freed, along with his mother, wife, and children, and headed for Mahmud and his private army in Waziristan. Hamza eventually joined her husband in Abbottabad, but security concerns would delay Hamza's own long-sought reunion with his father until it was too late. Around the same time as Hamza, Saif al-Adl was also released. He too made for Pakistan, and as we have seen, was in position to serve as interim emir on bin Laden's death, amassing pledges of loyalty for the sheikh's permanent successor, Ayman al-Zawahiri. Unlike Hamza, however, Saif later went back to Iran. We do not know the reason for sure. One of his wives apparently had stayed behind with their children, giving him a personal incentive to return and perhaps affording the Iranians some leverage to coax him back. But it is also possible that Zawahiri sent him on a mission to Syria, Iraq, or Yemen, for example, that required him to pass through the Islamic Republic on his way. Saif had served in the capacity of an emissary before and would do so again within a few years. Perhaps he was arrested in transit. Whatever the case, by the end of 2011, he was back in Iran with his fellow Shura council members Abu Khair and Abu Muhammad. Around the end of 2011, the Iranian authorities reportedly offered all three their freedom if they would return to their home country of Egypt. Each of them refused. This was prudent. Even with Mubarak gone and the Muslim Brotherhood ascendant, Egypt was not a safe place for marked men. At least in Iran, they were allowed to live with their families. In Egypt, they might very well face execution, as the Iranians were no doubt aware. As things stood, it would be another almost 4 years before the Shura Council III would taste real freedom. Over the course of 2013 and 2014, as the dispute between Julani and Baghdadi widened into a full-scale blood feud between Khorasan and the Islamic State, it seemed that at least some of the dire predictions about Ayman al-Zawahiri's leadership were coming true. The Egyptian may have inherited Osama bin Laden's portfolio and job title, but from his grave under the Indian Ocean, the Sheikh could pass on neither his innate aura of command nor his historical relevance to the global jihad. At the height of the feud, in July 2014, Zawahiri renewed his own and al-Qaeda's bayat to Mullah Omar, the Taliban leader. At the time, it seemed a smart symbolic move to underline the illegitimacy of Baghdadi's claim to supremacy. A year later, however, it emerged that Mullah Omar had actually succumbed to tuberculosis in April 2013. Either way, Zawahiri and al-Qaeda had pledged allegiance to a man who had been dead for 15 months. This looked bad for Zawahiri. Either he had known Omar was dead and sworn fealty to a cadaver, a grave transgression in al-Qaeda's Salafi jihadi version of Islam, or he had not known at all and was therefore too far out of the loop to call himself a true emir. The gaffe provoked ridicule from some jihadists, dismay from others. At a time when Zawahiri was already struggling to show his relevance in the age of the Islamic State, it seemed to confirm the worst fears about his leadership. We will never know whether Baghdadi and the Islamic State would have been able to defy bin Laden the way they did Zawahiri. But we can say with some assurance that bin Laden, with his charisma and compelling personal narrative, would have proven a tougher opponent. For Zawahiri, there was a limit to how far he could take things. The nuclear option would be to declare Baghdadi an apostate, which would amount to a jihadi death sentence. But the likely absence of any consequences for Baghdadi as a result would only further expose the weakness of Zawahiri's command. But Zawahiri does not stand alone at the prow of al-Qaeda. Indeed, his crew has recently grown significantly stronger. In an audio message recorded in May or June 2015, Zawahiri triumphantly introduced a man he called a lion from the den of al-Qaeda. After 4 years of silence following his father's death, Hamza bin Laden's voice could be heard once again, and his words remained faithful to al-Qaeda's message. He praised the leaders of AQAP, AQIM, and al-Nusra, insulted President Obama as the black chief of a criminal gang, lauded the attacks on Fort Hood and the Boston Marathon, and called for jihadis to take the battlefield from Kabul, Baghdad, and Gaza to Washington, London, Paris, and Tel Aviv. The implication was clear. Hamza, the Sheikh's son, is being prepared for leadership. Bin Laden's legacy lives. Even Islamic State supporters widely claim to be followers of bin Laden's al-Qaeda, as distinct from Zawahiri's al-Qaeda. If the Islamic State were once again stateless, and if bin Laden were once again at the head of al-Qaeda, IS jihadists might return to the fold and to the global form of jihad originally advocated by Hamza's revered father. If ever a chance existed to reunify al-Qaeda with its own wayward progeny, Hamza embodies that chance. Nor is al-Qaeda unique among jihadi groups in seeking to promote the progeny of an esteemed former leader. Under Haibatullah Akhundzada, the Taliban has brought in Mullah Muhammad Yaqub, son of the group's founder, Mullah Omar, as one of Akhundzada's two deputies. As is traditional in al-Qaeda propaganda messages, Hamza, in his 2015 statement, also called for the release of imprisoned al-Qaeda members, singling out in particular the sheikhs whom he credits with his education while in captivity, including the Shura Big Three, Abu Khair al-Masri, Saif al-Adl, and Abu Muhammad al-Masri. May God release them all, Hamza entreated. In short order, his prayer seemed to be answered. AQAP, in the midst of its Yemeni ascendancy, had been targeting Iranian interests. In December 2014, it bombed the Iranian ambassador's residence in Sana'a. And the following month, it shot dead an Iranian diplomat who resisted a kidnapping attempt. The group had also successfully taken two Iranian diplomats alive. Sometime in 2015, it swapped them for al-Qaeda's top three leaders in Iran, who made their way to a hero's welcome in Waziristan. The returning trio brought back with them a combined century of experience in jihad. Abu Khair, an expert in explosives, had led al-Qaeda's political committee, serving in effect as the group's foreign minister, and had sheltered Osama bin Laden in Kabul in the days after 9/11. Before joining al-Qaeda, he had been a member of the governing council of Egyptian Islamic Jihad, so he was close to Zawahiri too. Abu Muhammad had once been in charge of al-Qaeda's training arm and had worked with Saif al-Adl to train Somali militants in the early 1990s and plan the 1998 East Africa embassy bombings. American intelligence officials have called him al-Qaeda's most experienced and capable operational planner not in U.S. or allied custody. And then there is Saif al-Adl, whose long career has included serving in the Egyptian armed forces, helping to found al-Qaeda, precipitating the Black Hawk Down incident in Somalia, acting as a mentor to Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, serving as al-Qaeda's head of security, with intimate involvement in virtually all the organization's terrorist attacks up to and including 9/11, and at the time of his arrest, working to procure nuclear weapons. All three men were closely involved in al-Qaeda's first major blow against the United States, the embassy bombings of 1998. All three were on the Shura Council on September 11, 2001. And after a long absence, all three are now back in harness. Of the three senior returnees from Iran, Saif may be the most dangerous. Regardless of what he may or may not do, the contents of his brain alone rank as one of al-Qaeda's most potent weapons. Indeed, Khorasan has tried to bring his knowledge to a wider jihadi audience and in so doing reintroduce Saif himself as a leader through a series of essays on strategy and tactics published under his name. With someone like Saif al-Adl, the former jihadist Noman Ben Otman has said, you don't even need him to be active himself. What he has in his head is enough. Some reports have placed him in Syria, and indeed, his military expertise would make him a considerable asset in that conflict. But his movements have so far not been confirmed. Saif's release comes at a time when al-Qaeda's main global affiliates, AQIM, AQAP, and the bin Ladenist faction in Syria, are going strong, bolstered by ongoing turmoil in Syria, Yemen, and Libya. They have resisted the blandishments of the Islamic State, although IS has been able to shave off a few fighters here and there. AQAP's new leader, its former military chief, Qasim al-Rehmi, is an al-Qaeda stalwart. He trained in Afghanistan before 9/11 and went on to plot bombings at multiple foreign embassies in Sana'a. In 2006, Rehmi was one of those who broke out of prison alongside the late Nasser al-Wuheshi, an event that has acquired almost mythical significance in al-Qaeda. Within days of Wuheshi's death in mid-2015, Rehmi had reaffirmed the group's bayat to Zawahiri in gushing terms, calling the Egyptian the eminent sheikh and the beloved father. AQAP remains al-Qaeda's most dangerous franchise, largely because of its success in taking advantage of the chaos created by Saudi Arabia's ill-starred intervention in Yemen's civil war. In response to the Islamic State's harvest of bayats from around the world, Zawahiri has even announced the formation of a brand new affiliate, al-Qaeda in the Indian subcontinent, led by a former commander in the Pakistani Taliban, aims to unify Sunni extremist jihadis across the region and rescue Muslims living in Bangladesh, Myanmar, Assam, Gujarat, and Kashmir. The new group has already claimed responsibility for a series of public murders of secular political commentators in Bangladesh. Meanwhile, al-Qaeda's Waziristani nerve center, Khorasan, continues to enjoy the protection of the Pakistani Taliban and the powerful Haqqani network, which has ties to the Pakistani security services. successive Taliban leaders have lavished praise on al-Qaeda in general and Zawahiri in particular. Shortly after Mullah Omar's death was announced in July 2015, Zawahiri pledged allegiance to his successor, Mullah Mansour. When Mansour himself died in a May 2016 drone strike, Zawahiri was again quick to pledge allegiance to the new Taliban leader, Hibatullah Akhundzada. On May 9, 2016, one day after Zawahiri issued his latest call for unity among the jihadi groups fighting in Syria, al-Qaeda posted a second audio message from Hamza bin Laden, entitled, "Jerusalem is but a bride whose dowry is our blood." The statement reiterated Zawahiri's plea for unity and urged jihadis to think of the Syrian conflict as a springboard to the liberation of Palestine. "The road to liberating Palestine," he said, "is today much shorter compared to before the blessed Syrian revolution." And as in his previous message, he encouraged lone wolf attacks on Jews and Jewish interests around the world. Clearly, Hamza bin Laden is being prepared for leadership. Analyze the fortunes of jihadi groups for long enough, and you begin to see a clear pattern. The Taliban, for example, began as an insurgent group, one of many to emerge from the wreckage of Afghanistan's civil war. It conquered some territory for itself and became a proto-state. Then 9/11 happened, the United States invaded, and the Taliban, whose support in most parts of Afghanistan was feeble enough to begin with, lost its grip on government. But it did not go away. Instead, it morphed again, this time from a proto-state into a terrorist group, responsible for a long string of bloody attacks across Afghanistan and Pakistan. Over the ensuing decade, the Taliban has used violence to promote itself once again into an insurgency. As of this writing, it controls a number of provinces of Afghanistan and is vying for control of several more. Al-Qaeda, of course, began as a terrorist group. Its early experiments in governing in places like Somalia, Mali, and Yemen having failed, it fell back on terrorism. Now, in the long aftermath of the Arab Spring, it is fighting insurgencies in a number of countries, most notably Yemen and Syria, but has wisely held back from attempting to govern before it has built the requisite public support. The Islamic State's history is somewhat different. It grew out of the Iraqi insurgency against the United States before officially joining al-Qaeda. After years of setbacks following Zarqawi's death, the Islamic State of Iraq found itself demoted to mere terrorism, albeit of a particularly bloody and divisive kind. But since the beginning of the war in Syria, it has rapidly cycled through insurgency once more to become a proto-state, a caliphate in its own terminology. Now, as it faces steady decline in Iraq and Syria, the Islamic State is fighting an insurgency in Libya and has shown its enduring capacity to commit terrorism around the world. Indeed, IS seems to know that its role is changing, as evidenced by messages such as al-Adnani's May 2016 call for lone wolf attacks. The stages in this jihadi life cycle, terrorism, insurgency, proto-state, can be mapped roughly onto the three phases outlined in The Management of Savagery: creating chaos, capitalizing on it, and finally establishing a state. No doubt the author of that volume never intended his phases to be thought of as cyclic. But this ability to morph from form to form goes some way to explaining the terrible endurance of jihadi groups like al-Qaeda. More urgently, for present purposes, if the Islamic State is in the process of regressing to a stateless terrorist group without territory to govern, its dispute with al-Qaeda over the status of the caliphate becomes moot, and a reunion becomes ideologically possible for both groups, all the more so with Hamza rather than Zawahiri running the show. For 20 years, the global body politic has been infected with a virulent disease. The name of this malady is Bin Ladenism, and the self-proclaimed Islamic State is merely its most recent symptom. As its impetuous behavior makes clear, IS thinks and acts exclusively in the short term. it succeeded in conquering large swatches of Iraq and Syria because at first nobody tried particularly hard to stop it. Within weeks of the advent of American airstrikes, it became clear that IS had already reached its high water mark. As presently conceived, it lacks a long-term future, although some of its members can no doubt look forward to long careers in terrorism. By contrast, many powerful interests have been trying for a long time to destroy al-Qaeda, and the group has outflanked them all. Indeed, since 9/11, it has actually increased its membership and its geographic reach. This new stateless al-Qaeda possesses distinct advantages over the Islamic State. Its decentralized structure makes it almost impossible to pin down. Like a B-movie vampire, try to drive a stake through its heart and it transforms into 1,000 bats and flies somewhere else. Contrast this with the Islamic State, now forced to defend its self-styled caliphate at high cost. When the world eventually summons the will to rid itself of this criminal movement, it knows where to find it. Not so with al-Qaeda, whose subgroups stretch out in a loose band across the breadth of two continents and whose sympathizers pepper the globe. The organization's fanatic patience, its insistence on playing the long game, has made it far more resilient than anyone expected. For today's al-Qaeda, there is little profit in antagonizing the West with spectacular terrorist attacks. Instead, its strategy for the present involves building up resources and territory in places like Syria, Yemen, and North Africa, while the world is distracted by the Syria conflict. When the Islamic State finally crumbles, however, the spotlight will return to al-Qaeda. At that point, they will strike, and strike hard. With bin Laden's filial heir and ideological successors firmly back in the fold, and the group's affiliates making territorial gains in Yemen and elsewhere, al-Qaeda once again has the means and the opportunity to attack. All it waits for is the right time.